surprise. It's not even. That even surprised the voices of faith that are here. It's 6:30 California time. We're not supposed to come on until 7. But this gives me a shot at you before the general crowd, including all the riffraff, tune in. I'm noticing something, and I don't like it at all. The double portion has been a thank offering, a gratitude offering. And I'm noticing that what happened with the lepers is still true. He healed 10. One came back to thank him. He said, went through 10. Where's the other 9? I don't. To my regular people, and we never expect anyone to give to this ministry except those that have first received. I say again and again, don't send any money till you've first been taught. Then what's the teaching worth? And as you're taught, you'll find God doesn't need our money. He gives us an opportunity to worship Him. You know, like children that love their parents give. And sometimes they give parents things that parents really don't need, but the parent appreciates what the kid's doing. I read a book recently written by a person, it was a novel, under the guise of being written by a person in prison. He remembered working and working and working to get a ring for his mother. And he really worked. He mowed lawns and he ran errands. And then when he went to the jewelry store with his little product of child labor, there wasn't anything that he could buy with his little bit of money. In the last stop, the mother's looking in the jewelry store, and he comes out crying. And she takes him to the car and tells him no one had ever done for her what he had done, all that work and effort, and just didn't have enough. But the mother was more than satisfied as she enveloped him with her response. When God's got angels to do his work, and as I preached this morning, he's constantly shepherding us. We really are stiff-necked, stubborn, rebellious, dirty little sheep. You know, Mayor Reardon would have made himself proud if he'd told that little girl who said, "Isis, does my name mean Egyptian princess?" No, darling, it's better than that. It's Egyptian goddess. You don't do what he did to a child, and I know Reardon. He always gets his foot in his mouth. And he meant it to be a joke. That wrongly focused. We are, truly, we are so named sheep. Rebellious, stubborn, hard-headed, dirty little sheep. The true spirit of Christ, Paul made it clear in 1 Corinthians 8 and 9, exhibited by the Macedonians. They begged with much begging that they might be allowed to participate. The giving nature of the Spirit in them. And this double portion offering is a gratitude offering, and there's nobody in my congregation that does not benefit from the satellite. Very few of you are still around that will remember when it was impossible to be live anywhere but in Los Angeles for our ministry. We had to send tapes for a week's delay in Hartford. One of the biggest steps of faith we took was to build a connection of microwaves. And what rejoicing when we could finally connect the microwave and be live in San Francisco. In those days, we used to go to San Francisco and Hartford, and the folks in Los Angeles had to wait a week to see and participate in what we were doing. The devil thought he had silenced this ministry in May of 16, 17 years ago. Took from May till July for us to take the step of faith and have the opportunity to do it. And it was a blinding test of faith. $300,000 a month was our budget, and it was maxed out. To even get started, we had to spend about $300,000 in new equipment and connectors and the uplink. And to get 4 hours a day, we had to pay $200,000 a month. That plus the equipment doubled our budget. I asked the people to double portion for 3 months. I still remember standing on the platform Faith Center and saying, all I've done since I've been here is shore up broken walls, fight the enemy that's attacking the church on the rocks, get rid of the religious pirates, fight for our life. Will you give me a chance to do something positive? To take a leap of faith and stick it to the devil who thought he silenced us, and double portion your giving for 3 months. They did. We were able to do it in the 17 or 18, whatever it is, years is the history. And we went live for that 4 hours the first time on the 4th of July of that year. That's why we call it our Freedom Sunday. It broke us free. And now we cover the world and all the rewards of eternity you share in. But in teaching on praise, we're to remember and look back and rejoice. Some of you are just drinking in freely. You never fought in the wars. Others of you fought in the wars and are just tired and fatigued. And you're guilty of, don't be weary in well-doing, you're guilty of being weary in well-doing. And you fail to understand that all that you did is for naught. If you don't continue the course, we'll reap in due time if we faint not. Now I'm looking at a little less than half. Every year, for all these years, I've come at July and said, for those of you that have benefited from the satellite, that means you've benefited from the ministry, because that's the way it comes to all of you. Will you show your gratitude and fling us forward by doing a double portion thank offering in July? Not complicated. You double your ordinary giving. You double your tithe, you double your offering. You know how to add one and one? It makes two. Every year, there's been a number. It reached that number, and it never seemed to go beyond it. But this year, it's half. A little less than half of the number of double portion participants. I'm also noticing something else. You can't be... It's the age-old sin. If I can't reduce the performance down to my level, assuming I don't want to stretch myself, I'll just disappear and won't participate at all. One of the greatest blessings that has happened in this ministry is the foundation of 300 volunteers. Oh, I'm seeing some of them weaken in their commitment as we continue the logistical organization of assigning you your activities and your posts. But what is more devastating is I'm seeing people that, well, I can't give the 12 hours, so I'm going to stop doing what I'm doing. That's what's so devastating, is to see some of you, which can only be explained by misplaced guilt and pride. I'm not willing to give the 12 hours, or at least from my perspective, I don't see that I can yet. So you stop doing the 3 and the 4 and the commitments that you were already doing. I mean, the same truth brings life to some, death to others. Why drift away because you're not willing to make the whole commitment at this time? I made that clear from the beginning. You don't tie the pastor's hands. We don't tie our government's hands. There's a difference between Delta Force, Special Forces, Navy SEALs. Every war that's ever been fought has a regular army and then has Special Forces. What kind of listening to the devil are you doing? Instead of applauding and praying for those that have made the commitment, praying for God to help you to make more commitments, if not the whole commitment, praying for the Lord to let you compensate in other ways, like double portion month. Instead of retreating into your guilt and pride and inadequacies. If you've listened to me preach at all for these 30 years, there's no stopping point. We got to keep passing through. Now, it is a spiritual crime that in my 30th year, the double portion opportunity is reduced down to half the normal participating. What would you do in your spiritual life if this ministry just stopped tonight? I don't threaten those kind of things, not my style. But you need to stop and think. You're taking things for granted. Someone sacrificed 3 months and made this possible. And a host every year has sacrificed to keep it moving forward. What's the matter with you? You can't rise to the challenge this 1 month and give double portion, saying, "Thank you, Lord." What's my teaching mean? You can't say, "Thank you, Lord, you healed him and we've had almost 4 more years of teaching." What kind of Christian says this ministry produced? More riffraff like the rest of Christianity? Self-centered, self-seeking, blind, self-indulgent, spiritual hypocrites? Or did we really produce some uncommon men and women who will put God first, who gave his all for you? I'm seeing the same thing with Secret 16. That ribbon stays in place. You got spoiled. We had a couple of secrets where you could see what you saw at Hope Street. Stone, steel, or something that was specific. Those who come here to work, they see what Secret 16 is. Voices of Faith go to the handicapped restrooms that are not yet finished. Every part of this ministry has been in the process of being restored, built up, made solid for the days ahead. Again, what kind of Christians do you think I'm lying to you? I will not raise money for projects. I mean, are you such a stupid fool that you do not understand that I have kept us free where other ministries have toppled? The minute that we raise money for a project, if I didn't have the spiritual reasons for not doing it, the minute we raise money for a project, we have thrown the key to Antichrist to come in and supervise what we do. I will not compromise as other ministries to get the money. Play to your carnality, because if you can see your name or say, I helped build that, or you can see the specific project, or you'll pour it out. No, you give God's way for the teaching. I will not tell you what the secret is. And I make the commitment to God that I will do it whether you give or don't give. And most of the time, I'm the largest participant in the accomplishing of the purpose. You don't give me credit for the wisdom to steer us through the ever-growing encroachments of Antichrist. You're listening to the man that postponed Antichrist in California by the Petrus Bill. You cannot. Why do you think I want the money, the checks made out to me? Because I fought the wars where these goddamn governments, carnal, bureaucratic, lying imps from hell that suck off of our tax dollars and have the morality of a ground squirrel, wanted to say, we're only protecting the public, and we want to be sure that what you have given your money for is what the money is spent for. It ain't your money if you're given properly. But they want to protect you. And the best way they can protect to make sure that what you give your money for is what the money's spent for is to have your names and addresses. So they can go to each of you and ask, what did you give the money for? Because we now can go, we're going to church and see if they spent it. Some of you Johnny-come-latelys were not here when I'd no sooner arrived in town than a subpoena was settled on the church. We want the names and address of every donor that's given in the last 10 years, what each donation amount was, and what each donation was spent for. And I burned it on TV and fought the fight to get the Petrus Bill. They weren't interested in you having them help you see to it what you gave your money for was being spent for what you gave it for. They were interested in taking control of the church. Always this hypocritical stuff. There's no honesty in government anymore. Look at the lies that got us in the war in Iraq. I refuse to bend. There's more honesty in my church per square centimeter of flesh than any single office in any bureaucratic center in this world. There's more crooks in government than any other population group in America. The mafia is more honest than they are, because you get killed if you're not. Go see the Godfather again, this smart aleck daughter of a senator saying to the son of the Godfather, well, my dad doesn't send people out to kill and get killed. Vietnam, caused by lies. There was no Gulf of Tonkin incident. It isn't just Republicans. In that case, it was Democrats. I will not bend. They weren't interested. A charitable trust only is allowed to exist by the permission of government, because it's doing things that if it weren't done, your tax dollars might be needed to do. You therefore have a right, if you give to a charitable trust, if they're trying to preserve trees on the east side of the Sierra, you have a right to make sure that the money spent for that. If it's cancer research, you have a right to know your money given for that purpose is spent for that. That's what a charitable trust is. And a charitable trust, by definition, you know, I'm so sick of people. I'm like Paul, I'm sick of being taken for granted. Like a bunch of teenage kids too ignorant to understand what their dad has gone through and learned. Most of the pastors in California that are the beneficiary of what I did were criticizing me for doing it. They know about as much about a charitable trust as they do flying a space machine. A charitable trust, by definition, indefinite beneficiary. Church of England is a charitable trust because you are born into the church. Therefore, every person that ever lived in England, and every person living in England, and every person yet to be born in England is a member of that church constructively, and you choose not to be a member of that church. And the head of the church is the head of the state. That's old English common law. Thus, the church in England is a charitable trust. We had a revolution. Church in this country does not have an indefinite beneficiary, and the landmark case was established right here in Los Angeles, the members of the particular church on the roll of membership at that particular time are the beneficiaries. They're not indefinite at all. Indefinite beneficiaries are trees and cancer cells and the whole population group until no individual can come and represent them. Thus, the Attorney General is the sole representative of a charitable trust which has no definite beneficiary who can hire an attorney and represent himself. And that high and mighty statement was to get the Attorney General controlling churches. Only he could represent them. The members had no power. The board had no power. That's what I fought. A church can take on a charitable trust. You raise money for a particular project. You've done that. Don't sit out there and pass judgment on the way we do things here when you are too ignorant of the facts to even appreciate the way we're doing it. I have to count on people that have been bought with Jesus' own blood, who are members of the church eternal because they belong to Him, who call Him Lord and can claim His shepherding and give hilariously because of the opportunity, like Macedonian Christians, to have a part in what He's enriched you by making possible for you to do. Now, secret has become an old thing to you. God speaks to my heart. I set the plan. No secret we've ever done in these 2 years of Secret 16 is as valuable to this ministry as the things that are being done. I'm not talking about them in advance. I don't tell you any specifics. The minute I do that, I open a door that we closed years ago. You have to be intelligent enough to understand. You're supposed to be giving tithes and offerings. That's God's book. If you don't believe it, you're not a part of this ministry. The tithes of the Lord, the first fruits of the Lord's. Offerings in addition. He said in Malachi, you've robbed me in tithes and offerings. Offerings go beyond the basic tithe and are out of that hilarious heart of love that gives. And when I name a secret, 16 now, you're showing trust in the pastor that God has given you, who for these many years has demonstrated that kind of integrity and protection for the church. And you should be hilariously jumping at the chance to participate. I've had a challenge ever since Hope Street. Will I ever get this congregation to do, for no reason other than their love of God's Word, what they did when there was a building in sight? It's a crime that Secret 16 is stuck there at 150 of the 700 giving 3,000 by Christmas, and half the year's gone by. Divide up by the day what $3,000 would come out. You could lose some weight and skip one meal a day and probably pay the $3,000. You could drive the same car for another year and certainly come up with probably the $10,000. Something's happened to this congregation. You remind me of the Lakers who quit wanting to be a champion. 100 of the 300 giving 10,000 by Christmas. Well, we used to have the goal is 700 giving 10,000 by Christmas. I'm seeing it every time. I lower the challenge. It lowers the performance. This is what faith is about. Some of you should be reaching longer, not shorter. But the most crying impact is to sit here and see half of the normal people, half of the normal number, and we're halfway through July, have committed to double portion. No, I can't make you do it. If that many members of this congregation have backslidden in their commitments, I'm not going to do about it. Just keep preaching, teaching, follow my shepherd, and doing what we're doing. But I pray that some words will wake you up, and this number will change, and you will understand you are not your own. You're bought with a price. And get back in the saddle and start riding on this trip that we're taking to eternity. Now get on the telephone. Glad to see you all. But we were here 30 minutes ago, and I gave a little pastoral speech to my congregation. Most of you that listen on Sunday night know, even on KDOC, I dedicate the first half hour and sometimes the first hour to my congregants. This is where I pastor them. All week long, from 10 to 11, Monday through Friday, we're on every night on KDOC here in Los Angeles. Open with a song, teach, close with a song. That's it. Sunday night, we're here for 4 hours. And I'm going to tell you in advance, I've decided to break the rule, and we are going to replay about 2 hours and 10 minutes from now. We're going to replay the service as it occurred in the cathedral this morning. I think the message is one that all of you need to hear. But I spent the last 30 minutes talking to my congregation, and just as we were coming to going live on 56, I said, get on the phone. So I'm going to say to those of you that joined us, where were you the previous half hour of my congregants? Most of you have a satellite, shortwave, internet. You know we're on 24 hours a day, all over the world. And I was complaining that the double portion of July, which is a thank you time for those that benefit from the teaching 24 hours a day. Some 17, 18 years ago, all across Los Angeles, they wrote the epitaph for this ministry. One headline said, Scott's Last Hour on Television. Well, that was May. By July, we had opened a door to go on satellite, and satellite was still new in those days. It took doubling our budget in 1 month, and I asked people to give double portion for 3 months, and they did it. And the rest is history. Every July, we ask those that have been taught and those that benefit from the satellite ministry. If we didn't have the satellite, we'd have to be sending tapes down to KDOC. everything comes from the satellite. And every July we ask those that are the serious congregants whose life has been affected and changed by the teaching, and knowing you can get it 24 hours a day, to say thank you by double portioning your giving for the month of July. Not 3 months as the original group, just 1 month. And I was shocked and disappointed to look down and see the number of those that had committed. It's a little less than half of what has been the average every year for the last 17 or 18 years. I don't know what's happening. All I know is this congregation is built on faith, and built on faith and sacrifice. And I want to wake you up and say, come on, this is your once-a-year chance to say thank you for the ever-present teaching round the clock, and join with those who made it possible the previous years by making this sacrifice. Your turn now. Double portion for the month of July. I want this number back up where it belongs. It's only about a little less than half of the normal of the commitments every year. So get on the telephone and join the team. You know, the satellite makes possible Washington, D.C. We're back in San Francisco every night. Sunday morning, Dallas, Nashville. We keep expanding. This is what the satellite accomplishes. Dallas, Texas. I watch on Sundays. I've been watching for a month. This program's absolutely phenomenal. The way Dr. Scott covers things other preachers do not. Please keep up the good job. Paris, Texas. Thank you, Dr. Scott, for a wonderful message. I'm very proud and lucky to have Dr. Scott as my pastor. That's kind of you, and thank you. Ha ha, listen to this. I really enjoy listening to Dr. and Mrs. Scott sing together. But it's not the singing that I do. I notice how much Mrs. Scott loved Dr. Scott while they were singing. That brings a sing out of me. Here's another one. Fort Worth, Texas. I enjoyed listening to Dr. Scott's message and Mrs. Scott's singing. Okay. Dallas, Texas. You got that, didn't you? Dr. Scott's message and Mrs. Scott's singing. Thank you for being in Dallas. I never realized that the barefoot kinsman equated to the law. Thank you for revealing that to me. God bless you. These are gratuitous comments. I can do the same from Nashville, Dallas, San Francisco. Come on, folks. Get on board. Get on the telephone. Now, I want you to understand, and again, I'm talking to my congregants. We don't appeal to anyone to give to this ministry except those that I've taught. We don't ever sit here and threaten to go off the air if you don't give so much money. I want people to understand the dignity of proper giving. God doesn't need our money. We need to give His way. And only to my congregants am I saying, if you haven't been taught by me, you shouldn't be sending anything. My congregants know. But occasionally I have to remind you, everything above the tithe and the first fruits, which God lays first claim on, the tithe of the Lord, the first fruits of the Lord. Every other offering, including Secret 16, and Secret 16 has to be above the tithe. So it's an offering. Thus it counts everything that you are giving, double portion, including the doubling of the tithe. That really is an offering. I'm asking you to double your giving, which if you tithe, then you're going to give double the amount, but it's an offering. All of that, the double portion amount, above the tithe and the offering, the first fruits, and that's in January, counts towards Secret 16. I got a note from someone that double portioning and they're working on their Secret 16, which may suggest, not necessarily, that they think that the double portion doesn't count towards Secret 16. Yes, it does. You understand that?
Yes, sir.
Now, come on, get on the phone and I need about another 300 reservation for the cathedral on Sunday, and next Sunday night is Shalom service at King's House 1, 7 p.m. You have to make reservations for that too, but don't try to get double mileage out of your call. You have to make the reservations in two separate calls. A call to make the reservation for the cathedral, another call to make the reservation for Shalom service. Because these messages that are filled out are separated and put in the stack to mail the passes for the cathedral and another stack to mail the passes for the Shalom service. I don't have to tear the message in half. You make two calls. You're reserving the cathedral, that's one call. You make another call, you're reserving Shalom service. You know, if you work with Scott, I have a rule. If you have a choice between the hard way or the easy way of getting the job done, you do the hard way. You make two calls, you understand?
Yes, sir.
Well, then do it. Get on the phone. Well, I'm getting messages from people thanking Mrs. Scott and me for the changes that you see here in this building. We don't announce them. You've got to come here to see them. But Secret 16 is moving along. Claremont. Doc, we're among those who double-portioned for 3 months to go on satellite those many years ago, and we've never stopped double-portioning as a base since then. We also are reconfirming the Secret 16 pledge. Thank you for leading us all this way and for never letting us down. You're welcome. I want to thank those of you like that have never let me down. Where's the rest of you? Come on, get on the phone. To you that have television or watching, you're seeing pictures of the really glorious Bible collection on display at the cathedral. I spent a lifetime collecting those manuscripts. They're necessary for my own research and teaching, but they are maybe the best kept secret in Los Angeles. When Dr. Lamp was here last time, he's part of a group that are exhibiting, being invited by cities to exhibit a month in city auditoriums that 20 and 30,000 people show up. They charge $15 per person to come in and see him. And he gave me a list of the Bibles on display. If we were to put them in the cathedral, you couldn't find them. You'd lose them in the midst of the collection we have there. 60-some stations of the book. You can bring your family and spend 30 minutes before or after the service, and you will have a complete education in how we got our Bible. You will not see, it's the greatest collection in private hands anywhere in the world. Our Geneva Bible collection long ago passed the British Museum, Huntington Library, and New York Central Library. We have more, and they're all unique exhibits of that famous Geneva Bible that came over on the Mayflower, and it took at least 200 years for the King James to supplant the Geneva, particularly with the Calvin notes in the margins. We have the greatest collection ever assembled. Only copies known in many cases. That's what you've been looking at on the screen. Now, the next half hour, I'm going to do something that's pretty entertaining. But right now, I want my congregants to run these double portion commitments up in your reservation for the cathedral. And when you're going to get on board with Secret 16, half the year is gone, and you and God got to get it done by Christmas. So you have plenty to do. Get on the telephone. Well, here's a simple message. Anybody could do that. Thank you, Dr. Scott. I love you. That's a nice message. Nice to know if you called and said, I'm praying for you on a daily basis. I hope those of you that fasted and prayed and brought me through the healing from cancer have not quit. And here from Fenton, Michigan. Pastor, I found a bookstore in Flint, Michigan, which says that they have the Jake Hess song on CD, Death Ain't No Big Deal. My plan is to pick it up tomorrow and send it to you immediately. Thank you, Pastor, for everything. I'm behind you 100%. Isn't that nice? Okay, you can stop calling now and sit down. I have a little entertainment I want to do. Last night we interrupted regular programming, or my wife did, because we had some sound problem last Sunday, and we were unable to find anything. All the connectors were proper, possibly human error somewhere. But we wanted to be sure this morning that it would be okay, so last night they interrupted the programming and let you listen in on practice time as the camera people are trained and the musicians are down there faithfully every Saturday night. And the interruption was to see if the sound would be all right for 15 minutes, and it was. But some other things went on. They had that tension on them. And a couple of musicians were late. And my wife is as tough a taskmaster as I am. And sure enough, when they called in, they made excuses. There's a fire. Well, there were some other people who lived in the same area that figured out that the fire was going before regular time. You know, the fire had been going all day. So you take a different route and you leave earlier. Don't give me that excuse. And she didn't allow it either. But, you know, the musicians are human and they were a little rattled. And when I saw this, I said, I'm going to share this. I'm going to let the people tune in on the practice session, you know. Every Sunday morning, these faithful musicians, and they are committed. I mean, in this 30 years, I've eliminated bad musicians. And I've often said, and it's absolutely true, the more the gifts, the greater the danger. And there's no greater gift in the eyes of the world than music. I mean, if you're a good musician, they'll forgive any kind of crime, ethics, morals. And it's getting that bad with the sports world. You know, they can make a basket, everything's forgiven. You know, it's too bad they don't stone people for adultery in today's world. Should have paid them $136 million. Now, you can interpret that any way you want to. I'm innocent. No, you're not innocent. Maybe innocent until proven guilty, but you confess to adultery, and that makes you not innocent. Well, are you going to now start throwing stones at adulterers? No, I'd have to throw the rocks at every member of my congregation. Because Jesus said the thought's as bad as the deed. What I dislike is the fact that people act like they've done nothing. And just because they are gifted, that is a double standard. They get away with things that ordinary people not allowed to do. And they seem to have no sense of responsibility. That's the world. The church, you make a commitment, we want you to keep it. And the thing I was beginning to say is that churches have had problems in two areas. Judas was the first church treasurer, and look what he did. He carried the bag. So I've noticed, as I've studied churches for years, the minute people touch the money, you've got problems. And I was talking in the earlier half hour, why that I say you give to this ministry, you make the check out to James God. I'm the teacher. The Bible says in Galatians 6, if you've been taught in the Word, koinonia, mutually share with the one who taught you. And all good things, carnal things. But there's another reason. When I was fighting the battle to keep the Attorney General out of churches and recognizing that Jefferson was right, the price of freedom's association with nuts. I'm quite sure the LA Times would like to do away with the scandal, throw away magazines. But you encroach upon their freedom, which all too often is the freedom to publish lies, with no journalistic responsibilities. They're going to lose their freedom too. I remember the last night here on television, 17, 18 years ago, the so-called last hour on television. Every news media in town was here. When I chose to not pursue our license rather than expose and give the government the right to see the names and addresses of every donor, which gives Antichrist the power to put you out of business. The First Amendment is a single amendment. There are case after case at the Supreme Court level. What's good for freedom of press, good for freedom of association, good for freedom of religion. If you can take it away in one area, it goes in the other. Same principles apply. They would not allow this government to come into existence as the colonies without recognizing there are certain rights that government and man cannot give or take away. And these priority position rights, the Bill of Rights, the government has the burden of proof to even intrude there. They violate, you claim that your constitutional rights are being violated in some other section, Commerce Clause, etc. Burden proof's on you. Government has to prove its right to even get into the territory of these priority position rights. And I'm sitting here, and the last hour before I pulled the plug, I remember one of the newscasters, every time the music would play, they'd come over to me like a bunch of piranha. And one of them said, why are you doing this? Because I believe in the Constitution. Oh, but you lost. I remember looking at him saying, you're too stupid to see that you lost too. They can intrude on the rights in that same amendment. The churches, they can intrude on the rights of the press. The price of freedom, I repeat, is association with nuts. But as we took that stand those many years ago, God has brought us back. And we're still here. This is the longest hour ever on television. One of the things the government was doing in those days was saying, we want the names and addresses of those who give to the church. As they had sent a subpoena, I just arrived as pastor. These weren't people that I had pastored. I just arrived. And the church was 28 years old. Congregational polity elected me pastor. Did a subpoena. They wanted the names and address of every person that had given to the church in the previous 10 years, what each donor had given, and what each donation had been spent for. Well, Ed Masry of Aaron Brockovich fame and I went on television. First, I sent a letter to the Attorney General and asked, Evel Younger was the man at the time, asked him and all 400 of his associate Attorney General to show up on TV and debate with me the constitutionality of that request. We hadn't done anything wrong. I burned the subpoena on TV. They didn't show the debate, so I burned the subpoena and started the fight that produced the Petras bill. But they were arguing, well, we want to protect the people, and we want to make sure that when you give your money, that your money is spent for what you gave it for. That's why we want the names and addresses of all the donors, so we can go to them and say, did you understand what you were giving for? And what did you intend your money to be used for? And then they'd come to the church and see that it was spent for that. And that's okay with a charitable trust. A charitable trust doesn't have any constitutional right to exist. It's a congressional or a state grant of privilege because these charitable trusts are doing things that help all population or some segment of it. The tax dollars might be needed for if they didn't do it. So you have a right. It is your money. You have a right to know what, that you, when you give it, if it's for cancer research, that's what it's spent for. And they put a limit on what, how much of that money can be used for administrative costs. I'm all for that. Charitable trust. Church is not a charitable trust. Church is not created by the government and has to justify its existence by the welfare good that it does. A church has a right to exist before the government was allowed to exist, and the government was allowed to exist because it recognized the right of the church to exist. That's America. That's why I want him to come and debate the constitutionality of it. Now, but, you know, while we were fighting the fight, and ultimately we won it by getting the Petras bill passed, I then said, okay, if that's what they want to make sure that the money that's given is spent for what you give it for, though it's not your money when you've given it, but, okay, I'll go along with that. So that's when I announced we'd receive no money here, unless you made the check out to Dr. Gene Scott, the teacher. And then I sent my in-house attorney down to the local representative of the Attorney General's office and said, now, you said the reason you wanted to do this was you wanted to make sure that those who gave the money knew that it was spent for what they gave it for. Now we will open our books and you come and make sure that all the money is spent on Gene Scott. Now, when are you going to come and carry out this high and mighty purpose to protect the public and make sure that what they gave the money for is what it's spent for? Now, he grumbled, we never said Scott wasn't smart. It was all a hypocritical pitch to get control of churches. But I have refused from that day until now to have the dignity taken from me. You're giving to the teacher. Now, up until now, I understand, but up until now, there is no one that can ever find a check that was endorsed to a personal Gene Scott account. But I have the privilege of saying, put it in a church account. I also have the privilege of saying I can take next Sunday's offering and put it in a private plane, fly out in the Pacific, dump it in the Pacific, because you are giving it to the teacher as a way of saying to God, what you said for us to do in Galatians 6, we've been taught in the Word, and we're going to share with the one who taught us in good things, and we're sowing to the Spirit, and we'll reap a harvest of life eternal, and we're not going to be weary in well-doing. I have protected the church by never compromising and never making our existence dependent upon you getting tax deduction credit, though we have the right to give it. Theologically, we believe in Matthew 6, you keep your giving secret. Don't fall into the trap of letting the government know what you give and to which church you give it. It's God's money, you give it to God, none of their business. So don't expect us to give you contribution credit. We have the right to. Well, theologically, we won't. Don't try to make double mileage out of your giving. You're giving to God It's not your money. You gave it. When I give you a Christmas present, I'm not going to come and see whether or not you use it for what I think you should use it for. I turn loose of it. And the tithe you give wasn't yours in the first place. It's the Lord's, and He tells you where to put it. But now I'm going to have some fun. Having said that, just thought I'd get it off my chest to you people that tune in to the Sunday night only. That's the way we do it here. Why do you have reservations at the cathedral? Keep the riffraff out. You want something complicated? I don't want church cramps. I mean, we don't put you through some kind of test. We don't ask you to prove you're a high school graduate. We don't ask you to get an official transcript of your graduation. We just want people there that know what it is, college-level teaching, and you want to be there to be taught, and you will be respectful of the house and the man that's teaching like you're in a classroom in college. That's simple. And the way you show that you want to come for that reason, there's no grading system. You don't have to be blonde or gray-headed. There's no age specification except those you can't get in the service under 12, but the pastor sends you with adult supervision. All the kids between 2 and 12 go on an air-conditioned bus to one of the museums within 15 minutes of the cathedral. And you can sit in the service and listen. Nursery below 2. 12 years old, it's a privilege for the kids to come in the cathedral. If you're a teenager, until you're of age or married, you sit with your parents, not discussable. We don't have any hoodlums. Don't have any troublemakers. Just like a college class. We just throw you out. Well, you can't do that. It's public service. Any public service. It's private service. I'm not dumb. I don't know how I'm going to read tonight because I've lost my lens, I see, somewhere in this studio. You don't read with glasses. So I don't know what happened. Maybe it's in my pocket. But I don't need to read tonight. I'll just, my wife's going to solve it and find something somewhere. You can have them, but there's no lens there, baby. So maybe you've done about everything else since we've been married. Maybe you manufacture the lens. But I don't see my glasses. So we'll see what I can do without reading. Wait a minute, what's this? Is that a pair of glasses that has a lens in it? It does. Okay. It's not the best, but it's there. Not the best. Now, I'll look around later. I want to finish my speech. I'm going to show something funny. We were all musicians, remember that?
Yes, sir.
This is live. Don't expect an agenda. No idiot cards. So they were late, and they were a little bit disperambulated. And when you hear the song on Sunday morning, we opened with the song, the medley, this morning. And it was right this morning. But they couldn't get the beat right last night. And they were so obtuse, there was no way she could communicate to them. She's going like this to slow it down. Eventually she starts, since they're going to keep that marching beat, she starts going like this. And then what's really funny is then when they finally got the message, she wanted them to slow that part of the medley down. Then when they went into the next part, they were going either too fast or too slow on that one. They reversed it. And that's when, you watch close, if looks would kill, I would have a bunch of dead musicians. And it alternates between laughing to keep from blowing up, laughing to keep from going insane. Laughing because if you get a couple of shots, the director wasn't moving around that fast. And finally, he even missed it on one, trying to get him to slow down. She's going, and the director only got a close-up, didn't get that. I think this is funny. This is entertainment. So you can see what goes on Saturday. Now, probably you'll make reservations to show up to practice. You ready with that back there? This is kind of funny. Yep. Now, they're going to sing the song, and it's not as well as it was done this morning because they're going, and they're just, they're going, and so she has to sing along. You have to go through the medley, 3-4 different songs, and not once did they get the beat right. So, alternating between laughing, glaring, body language, motions, all kinds of things. This is what goes into producing the song on Sunday morning. And she's pretty tough on you, right? She gets tough on you. You need it. Save me going down there. That's wonderful. So watch this. I think you'll find it entertaining. Now that I've told you basically what's going on, and we'll go past the hour and station break, and people will think, well, is that the best music they can put out? This is what it takes to get what we put out on Sunday. And that's it. Well, you know, she's human. I could see the patient sort of wearing thin toward the end. That's funny. That's funny. I mean, you know, all this suffering I had to do with staff, she's doing it. They're good musicians. But, like everything, you're out of sync sometimes. I mean, how many dozen times have they played that song? But you got it right this morning. I wish they had kept the camera on you a little longer, Reggie. You were helping her out with trying to show them with your body language what the beat they were doing. You like that?
Yes, sir.
That was funny. Well, I want to say a happy birthday. I heard that this weekend or this week, George Putnam reached his 90th birthday. I love the man. He's one of the true journalists. He's an institution in Los Angeles. Proud to call him friend. And when we did the telethon to save the books after the tragic fire at the Central Library downtown, we had guest galore. I remember it was really funny when the Attorney General came as a guest. But everybody helped with that telethon. Henry Kissinger, various movie actors, and sports figures, and celebrities. George Putnam was one. Now, there's a black mark across the screen because we put out the number that was used direct to the Save the Books campaign when we did the telethon. But in celebration of George Putnam's 90th birthday, I'm going to play that famous song he sang. Ah, there's only one George Putnam, and there'll never be another one. Another one like him. Happy birthday, George. And another 20 years, 30 years. As long as he's out there swinging, I know I've got a lot of time to go. Now, I've been talking. It's time for you to get on the phone for about 10 minutes. Some of you joined late. My congregants are those to whom this remark's addressed. We only have about, now it's moved up, it's over half now, but when I sat down, a little less than half of the normal number of my congregation, double portioning in July. I don't have to tell you why, you already know. And I get that number back up, and I need another couple hundred reservations for Sunday, so get that going too. Get on the telephone. Shalom service Sunday night, 7 p.m. at King's House 1. In addition, I think they turned me off, so I'm going to say it again. Shalom service Sunday night at 7 p.m. in addition to the regular 11 a.m. service at the cathedral. Two different locations, the cathedral at 11, King's House 1 in Glendale at 7. Voices of Faith can tell you how to get there. You have to make separate reservations for each service. 7 p.m. Sunday, the 25th of July, at King's House 1, Shalom service. 11 a.m., the regular service at the cathedral next Sunday. You have to make reservations for both services. Get on the phone. Okay, no more calls. Everybody sit down. One of the truly great Christian writers of the last two centuries, C.S. Lewis, If you check the tape and book list and watch for the programming, I did a whole series of teachings on some of his books. Among the most famous one is Screwtape Letters. Now, I have a classic collection I've assembled, like I collect the Bibles. I have a classic collection of all of C.S. Lewis' works. And I remember going through Screwtape Letters, which is a perfect illustration of C.S. Lewis's imaginative talent. And he postulates Screwtape is an old veteran demon, and Wormwood is a young recruit. Now, Wormwood is needing coaching by Screwtape, so Screwtape writes him letters. And the terminology, everything is reversed, because the enemy is Jesus, and their master is the devil. And they're seeking to break people loose from the enemy and set them free from the enemy into the clutches of the devil. Now, Wormwood thinks he's been doing a particularly good job, and Screwtape takes him to task, because Wormwood is complaining that he's not getting enough recognition from the world, that is. I mean, you know, he's doing a tremendous job for the devil, but nobody on earth knows about it. And Screwtape has to straighten him out, saying, we never had it so good. You know, never has it been a day like this. People don't believe we exist. They have all these harebrained ideas that the devil's got a red forked tail and horns and has to be a wild special effects appearances. And Screwtape is telling Wormwood, we never had it so good. Our goal is to get the job done. And they don't even know we exist. We're like secret agents, because we're in the first generation that doesn't believe the devil exists, so we can get away with anything. He's a talented writer, and everybody will have a copy of Screwtape Letters. The other one, I remember I occasioned upon it in my struggle with faith years ago. Mere Christianity. He says, when the guy that wrote the imaginative works that have produced the Lord of the Rings movies, very close friend of C.S. Lewis, and he once chided C.S. Lewis, what are you writing about theology and religion for? And in essence, C.S. Lewis said it in a nice way, but there's just so many idiots writing on the subject and talking in terms that nobody understands. He felt somebody needed to talk in terms that people could understand. It's from C.S. Lewis. I borrowed the phrase that when you confront Jesus, you do not confront someone like the founders of other religions that can be respected. Jesus made claims about himself that when you confront him, if he's not what he said he was, then he's of the order of a man that thinks he's a poached egg, because he makes impossible claims about himself. Mere Christianity is one of the most brilliant, incisive classics in defense of the Christian faith. And then I go to it periodically with his reflections on Psalms. And on, children's books are what he's most famous for in his Adventures in Narnia. But there's a new book that's just come out recently, The Magic Never Ends, the life and work of C.S. Lewis, an illustrated profile of one of the 20th century's most influential writers. Let's see if these glasses will work. Having known and scrutinized this remarkable man, the contributors to this volume help us to understand the growing interest in Lewis and his work. His stepson, Douglas Gresham, his posthumous editor, Walter Hooper, foremost Lewis archivist and lecturer, Christopher Mitchell, and Lewis scholars Lyle Dorsett, Colin Manlove, and Dabney Hart share their memories and insights into the Lewis legend. Now, what most people don't know is he received very little recognition until he died. It's people like this, the archivists and others, that determined to push his works, and he's become one of the most famous writers of all time. That's what the translators, not translators, but the transcribers are doing. It's 24 hours. We have 70, last count, 70,000 hours of teaching that is being transcribed and will be reduced to books. I'm too busy putting it out to do that. It's become a passion of my wife to get everything reduced to print and thus perpetuated by that medium. But I thought you might be interested in some of the things about Lewis in this volume. One I like very much. For medical reasons, I'm not too keen on cigarette smoking. I even listen to the arguments against cigars and pipes. The medical research is pretty obvious. But the cigars and the pipes you don't inhale, and it's not habit forming. And if you buy properly, not cheap stogies, you get pure tobacco without any mixtures put in. So I play the statistics, like when I fly in my jet, it's mine, so the pilots are working for me. And we won't fly through bad weather. We got caught the last trip to Dallas. That won't happen again. And they've got to show me a map that we're always within glide range of an airport. I mean, don't give me this business. I got to get right in the most rugged section of the Sierras and fly north all the way. File a flight plan or find a time you can get one. I played at percentages. I'm going to go through some thunderstorm up to 45,000 feet like we did out of Dallas. That's the third mistake I've made in my life. And I'm quite sure that the health risk of things I've been eating most of my life is worse than these cigars, but I accept that. What I don't accept is those who say it's a sin. Now, I can buy the habit-forming cigarettes, because Paul says all things are lawful. Well, I'll not be brought into bondage to anything. And I have zero tolerance for some hypocritical blimp of a preacher who obviously is sugar bound to a habit of sugar and gluttony, getting on somebody for smoking a cigarette. It's hypocrites that I don't like. I wave my cigar, not because I like it that well, though I've come to like it. To get good cigars, or it's kind of nice to blow smoke rings and relax from stress and move people away from you. But what I repeat, I just can't stand people saying it's a sin. I've memorized all the passages about sin. And don't give me this business, I repeat, of the temple of the Holy Ghost. I mean, you know, God seemed to like burning things. Burn offerings all the time. Don't give me that. Move out of Los Angeles if that's your kick. What you breathe in here is worse than... I mean, I smoke a cigar to cleanse the air sometimes. And again, what most of you put in your mouth sure isn't saying much to the temple of the Holy Ghost. Ask your stomach about it. The stomach of most of you would love to have you get super spiritual about the temple of the Holy Ghost and carefully put into your mouth what works through your system. What I'm crusading on is stop this self-righteous condemnation of everybody that breathes Stop pushing your views on everybody else of what you think personal holiness is. Live your own conscience. Preach Christ. But I take great pleasure in showing this picture. I don't know if we can get it on camera or not. Can you get around behind me? See, I don't think so. I got to get this somehow or other before I start reading. See if you can zoom in on this. Get close. That's a picture of C.S. Lewis in his most Christian time, when he was writing some of his masterpieces, and all these self-righteous preachers are forever quoting C.S. Lewis. Look at that right hand and see that little white thing between the fingers. You see what that is? Oh my God, cleanse the air, come and cleanse the air, blessed holy angels, wipe it off of the screen. C.S. Lewis sitting there smiling, smoking a cigarette. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, maybe the greatest evangelist ever to preach in England, smoked a cigar. And I've told you, I got the flower pot where G. Campbell Morgan used to stuff his cigar out before he went to the pulpit at the Hope Street Church. You're off my back. You know, you remind me of the ignoramus when I was in Bible school before I went to college. We're having a chapel service in the morning, and he gets up and starts ranting and raving about us going modernists, departing from the ways of God, talking about the Holy Spirit when the Bible clearly says Holy Ghost. Well, ghost conjures up spooks. Ghost conjures up comic strip characters. Same word, pneuma. God didn't write the Bible in English. He said pneuma. And it's equally translated ghost or spirit. Just ghost doesn't mean. Ghost does not enhance God's image in today's world. But this ignoramus is up there committing us all to hell. I am on a crusade to remove the ignorant from dominance in Christianity. And if the shoe fits, put it on your head. Now there's some things you may not know about C.S. Lewis. So I want to introduce you to some of them. On November 22, 1963, American President John F. Kennedy was killed by a sniper's bullet in Dallas, Texas. Thousands of miles to the east, the Beatles released their second album in London, a soon-to-be classic called With the Beatles. Acclaimed British writer Aldous Huxley died at the age of 69. And in the cloistered academic world of Oxford, England, the long career of C.S. Lewis ended with his death. He was 64 years old. C.S. Lewis' career was defined by scholarly pursuits in the medieval literature, apologetics, writings, and an imagination that brought magic into the lives of children and adults through a book series called The Chronicles of Narnia. His classic satire, The Screwtape Letters, had made Lewis a household name in both England and the United States. Still, at the time of his death, few people realized the scope and significance of his work, and little was known about his life. It's only now, with the distance imposed by time and the insights of a new generation of scholars, that we're beginning to realize his powerful contributions to literature and to learning. According to Dabney Hart, C.S. Lewis was an Oxford scholar. First and foremost, he was a great teacher. First and foremost, he was a Christian, countered Douglas Gresham. Secondly, He was a scholar. He was a fellow at Magdalen College, Oxford, and he was an Oxford graduate himself. He had 2 degrees from Oxford, spent his life in the academic world doing lectures and holding tutorials. He was also a Christian, and that marks who he is and the worldview he brings to his subject. He said, you can make anything by writing. You can make a world of your own. You can do what you want with it as long as it holds together. He also said, I'm a dinosaur. I don't belong. I come from a past age. A complex man, Clive Staples Lewis, who published under the name of C.S. Lewis and whom friends call Jack, was born in Belfast in Northern Ireland on November 29, 1898. The second of 2 sons, he lived in a boyhood home called Little Lee, or Little Leah, with his father, Albert James Lewis, his mother, Flora Augusta Hamilton Lewis, and his brother, Warren. In all that's been written about Lewis' childhood, 2 things stand out: the quality of his imagination and the deep sense of loss he felt at the early death of his mother. Lewis' imagination was visible in the games he and his brother, Warren, would play in the attic at Little Leah, such as creating a fictional world they called Boxen, because his parents thought he had a weak chest. Many diseases, such as typhoid and scarlet fever, were prevalent in Belfast at the time. They often kept Lewis inside. Lewis began creating stories. By age 10, he had begun writing. Then, the second thing that stood out about Lewis' childhood was the deep sadness and resentment he experienced at the loss of his mother. I'm going somewhere with this. Flora Lewis died of abdominal cancer when Lewis was just 9 years old. Clearly, the death of Lewis' mother was a watershed in his life, commented Mitchell. And it was doubly difficult because with the loss of his mother, he and his father began to grow apart. His father didn't recover. Now, I don't think it was as bleak as some people would make it out to be, especially if you read the letters that are exchanged in the family papers. There's a real affection by his father, but his father was never able to really engage in the way that I think the boys really wanted him to after the mother died. It isn't because he wasn't willing. I think he was just incapable. But the best person to talk about it would have been Lewis, and he really didn't say a whole lot about it. It was during the grief, and this is where I was going, it was during the grief that surrounded the loss of his mother that Lewis began to question the existence of God. According to Gresham, his son-in-law, or stepson, the great tragedy of his childhood was the loss of his mother when he was a little boy. That changed the whole pattern of his life. As the son of 2 devoted Christians, Jack went to church, believed in God and in Jesus Christ. But his mother's death was the first wedge that was driven into that masonry. As an early adolescent, Lewis began to drift toward atheism. Dorset said, when his mother was dying of cancer, he prayed and asked God to heal her. And of course, she died. And he believed at that time that God either wasn't there, or if he was there, he was just cruel. And he saw God as either impotent to do anything about it, or very cruel in the way he worked with things. And so the problem of pain and the problem of evil came into his life at an early age. Lewis himself reflected on the tragedy in his book, Surprised by Joy. Quote, with my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil, reliable, disappeared from my life. There was to be much fun, many pleasures, great stabs of joy, but no more of the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis. Lewis' subsequent upbringing by people other than his parents and the influence of other people began to shatter the structure of his Christian faith. Eventually, at one of his schools, he lost it completely. Now you know why I identify with C.S. Lewis, having gone through the, not the cause, but the period of losing faith when I was in college. Eventually, at one of his schools, he lost it completely, being a young man with an immensely powerful intellect and rational mind. He soon began to try to rationalize everything around him and to rationalize God out of his life. One of his tutors, William T. Kirkpatrick, was a rationalist and a humanist. He had the influence on Jack of making him think and search for truth much more deeply than he had before. Shortly after Flora's death, Albert Lewis sent his son to join his brother Warney at Wynard School in Watford, England. Am I boring you? A brutal headmaster made the experience nearly insufferable for both boys. However, Lewis had a dramatic literary experience at another boarding school in 1911. There, Lewis discovered Richard Wagner's Siegfried and the Twilight of the Gods, a story of Norse mythology. The idea of northernness was firmly planted in his imagination. Given his interest in fictional worlds, he had read Milton's Paradise Lost by age 10. Lewis grew to love these mystical stories of magic, dragons, and dwarfs. And it was at this time that Lewis really discovered literature on the legends and mythology of Northern Europe. For him, I think, literature was the primary source of his imagination, said Hart. His imagination was just saturated with the myths of the North, which he referred to and used very seldom, I think because he knew that most of his readers would not be familiar with those as they would be with the Arthurian legend or with the myths of the Greeks and the Romans. But he loved Norse mythology. By 1913, Lewis was gaining attention for his classical studies at England's Malvern College. While there, he authored Loki Bound, a pessimistic tragedy about Norse gods. It was a turbulent period in his life, and he was clearly searching. As he recalled in Surprised by Joy, it was during this time that he became an atheist. Lewis wrote, "I was at this time living, like so many atheists, in a world of contradictions. I maintained that God did not exist. I was also very angry with God for not existing. I was equally angry with Him for creating the world, though I didn't believe in Him." While in Belfast in 1914, a short time later, Lewis befriended a boy named Arthur Greaves. They remained lifelong friends, exchanging letters until Lewis' death. It was in a letter to Greaves in October 1916 that Lewis wrote, quote, "I believe in no religion. There is absolutely no proof for any of them. And from a philosophical standpoint, Christianity is not even the best. All religions, that is, all mythologies, to give them their proper name, are merely man's own invention, Christ as much as Loki of the Norse mythology." He went to Oxford. First World War came. He and his best friend formed a pact. His best friend was killed. The pact was they would take care of each other's family. At Oxford, he threw himself into his studies, and he remained identified with Oxford until he died. There's something else, though, I want to point out to you. There's a passage I'll find after a psalm about his prayer life. A man thoroughly changed. And this is why I'm very intolerant of those that throw Christianity out the window with very little knowledge of either, claim to have a knowledge, victims, empty-headed victims of scientism which rules this age. Here is a man not only qualified in intellect, very familiar with the alternates, lost his faith, became a powerful study of languages, Greek, Hebrew, German, French, Italian, multilingual, immersed in mythology and totally atheistic, captured by Christ, Mere Christianity, and his other works will tell you how he finally examined the evidence that's clear that I present every Easter in the message that I preach then. Men like this have my respect. While some coffee clutch yuppie that I can ask five questions and know he's never read a single bit of evidentiary work on the claims of Christ, who rules out the resurrection because it can't happen, therefore, if anybody says it did, they're either a nut or a liar, who rules out the uniqueness of Christ when they've not spent any time and don't even have the language to pursue it. I respect the person that says what one of my doctoral candidate associates at Stanford, who went on to be president of Ball State University in Indiana, he said, "Gene, I can't argue with your position that most of us that deny the claims of Christ have never looked, but the risk of looking and being convinced will so destroy all that I've prepared myself to be, I don't want to look." Well, now that I respect. He admitted his ignorance and was unwilling to take the risk that it might be true. That I can respect. But I can't respect these know-it-all talking heads that get very religious at Christmas time that haven't read any of the works. And I can't have much respect for the pharisaical, legalistic Christians that will draw upon C.S. Lewis and his wealth of writings because he's dead. But if they knew he smoked a cigar, a pipe, and a cigarette, they would walk on the other side of the street if their brethren saw them in the presence of C.S. Lewis. I'm telling you, folks, I'd rather be identified with a man like this than all these fanatical jump-around ignoramus preachers that are condemning me every day that they can and stealing my messages and claiming as their own. Thought I'd say that. Yeah, you know. And I heard somebody on television recently criticizing me because I made some remark about white suits. And he said, "I want to tell that critic that this white suit man has won these various ones to Christ." Well, I want to tell that man a whole bunch of people that came to Christ because they saw me smoking a cigar, and that caused them, because of the shock of it, to stop long enough to listen to the truth. Including Glenn Campbell, who made that testimony himself on national TV, including my friend in King's House, Merle Haggard. And, interesting enough, the same guy that criticized me, and that one I'm referring to, sat at my table and said, "I know why you smoke that cigar. Glenn Campbell never would have come to God if he hadn't seen you doing that." Well, you can always say, I say in private what I say here, and I say here what I say in private. What you see is what you get. There aren't two Gene Scotts, not one that smiles your face and then gets behind your back and tells you you're a worm. If you're a worm, if you ask me, I'll tell you. Now, get on the telephone, and I suggest that some of you that are interested in C.S. Lewis find this book, and if I can find his prayer life, I'm going to read that to you before we go into the service about 15 minutes from now. Get on the telephone. You know, I didn't find the section that I wanted. But one of the writers here said of C.S. Lewis, he prayed a great deal. I don't think I've ever come across a person who prayed so much. In a train, on a bus, on a walk, or just standing outside. The thing that struck me about him more than anything was that this man really loved God. The section I didn't find, someone else commented. He's praying all the time. They'd go in and interrupt him. He's praying. He didn't always pray on his knees. He just had so cemented his faith in the resurrection and the living person of Christ. He talked to him all the time. And I find some other sympathetic things. There are certain more fundamentalist-minded Protestants that have had a hard time with Lewis, especially because of certain lifestyle issues, such as his drinking and smoking. Oh, he's a great teacher, but his lifestyle offends me. Also, some would be against what they would call certain magical elements within his writings. Well, none of those fundamentalist critics made the cover of Time. They didn't make it for a good reason. C.S. Lewis made the cover of Time magazine. There's the picture. You see, because of Christian television, there's a certain frame of reference. And I used to say, I'm the other voice. There's a certain state of mind in America today that religious television represents normal Christianity. No, it doesn't. It's a freak show. It's a freak show. Some of the nuttiest and most uneducated and biblically confused people on earth are dominating Christian television. Bigness doesn't mean you're right. I mean, Luther was one man against the worldwide Roman Catholic religion. And I just want everybody to understand, I don't want their approval. That's a sure sign I'm wrong. I don't want their approval. If I get their approval, that means I'm one of them. And they'll say the Greek says this, and they can't write their name in Greek. You know, it's a freak show. I said that 30 years ago. I'm changed. I'm the same. They can learn from me. I can't learn anything from them. I don't want. But what grieves me is that the world thinks that's Christianity. No. This is Christianity. C.S. Lewis, first and foremost a Christian. Shaping and helping the faith of innumerable, countless millions around the world. The thousands of faithful pastors, like my dad was for 30 years in Oroville, instead of this freak show. Now, everybody's a doctor. I mean, I know most of them. It's become an embarrassment to refer to Dr. Gene Scott. That's why I put Stanford University on the bottom. I mean, you know, let's form a big mob of mutual support. And I'll give you a doctorate if you'll give me one. I can't even speak the English language accurately, much less New Testament and Old Testament languages. Now the women are getting in on it. Got all these women doctors now. Not gynecologists. Everybody's a doctor, you notice that? But you don't see under their name the school where they got it. I had to do that. Let's think, well, here's another one of these fake doctors. Now tell me that isn't hypocritical. Tell me that isn't lying. They don't know how to answer what I teach, so they just have to give themselves their own credentials. I've stood alone for 30 years. Don't get the idea because your pastor is saying to you, and you're watching secretly, that you shouldn't watch me. Paul says they preach Christ, I thank my God. I only get combative like this because I get sick and tired of these fat-gutted preachers condemning me for smoking a cigar and telling their members, don't watch me. I had one lady in the parking lot of a store saying, my pastor says I shouldn't watch you. I said, why? She couldn't tell me why. He just said, he shouldn't watch you. But my spirit tells me you're okay. Well, I said, why don't you listen to your spirit and find another pastor? Now, if, we're going to go to church now. We're going to go to the cathedral. I can't find this passage, but I suggest that you get this book if you can. Read his life story, the tragedies, the pain. Oh, there's another one, you know. He kept the vow to take care of the mother of his friend that was killed in the First World War, and then they were always circulating the stories. There's got to be something sexual going on. Well, what's anybody's business? Isn't that between God and the woman and C.S. Lewis? He taking care of this woman that was the mother of his best friend and her daughter? But they have to try to stain him. A man's life speaks for itself, and his work will last into eternity. I hate hypocrites. I love C.S. Lewis. Love J. Campbell Morgan. Love the old giants of history. Can't stand the freak show of modern day that just get up on TV and one-up one another to see who can be the hero that gets the most free time. So let's say that. Now we're going to the cathedral. We're going to the cathedral where God's Word is center stage, and we just teach.